This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin with a subject we've talked about before on the show, but it's always changing. It's evolving. It's a very interesting new industry, relatively new at this point, unmanned aircraft systems. And with us to talk about it is somebody with a fair amount of experience in it, in aviation in general, Tommy Kenville. He's the CEO of EyeSight RPV Services. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
How would you describe the state of the UAS, the drone industry in North Dakota today?
Oh, it's in its incubation stage. We're far along as a state as far as how far we've advanced. But overall, it's just getting going.
So what are the barriers to breaking out, really getting going?
Well, one of the biggest barriers was flying beyond visual line of sight. And so for the last 3 years, we've been flying for hire, which we just were able to do. 3 years ago, they allowed private businesses outside of government agencies to fly, but you had to be in line of sight. And so some jobs, that's fine. But most jobs, you need to let the plane go and to collect the data. And so, power lines, for instance, we just landed a 60-mile power line project. Well, if we have to keep the plane in sight, it takes us twice as long.
I saw that there was some interest in that in the previous summit I attended in Grand Forks about UAS developments in the state, that kind of remote sensing, if you will, of problems with power line distribution mm-hmm. systems is one of those areas that drones can do better than any other.
There's so many different uses for drones. One big one that we do right now, one of our big contracts, is inspecting wind blades, wind turbines. Well, they used to send a Doug or a Tommy scaffold up it to look at all the blades. It's dangerous. It's high. The technicians don't like inspecting them. They don't mind fixing them, but they don't like inspecting them. And wind blades get hit a lot by lightning. And so that's a job that it quicker, safer, faster, better information.
But again, you need to be there under the current rules. You need to be there so you can actually see the drone as it's doing the job. But beyond visual line of sight, this is air traffic control essentially we're mm-hmm. talking about now. And that has lots of wrinkles to iron out, doesn't it?
It really does. So it will be the drone operator's job to get out of the way of the manned aircraft. It'll be the drone operator's job not to fly where they're not supposed to be flying. But I do believe we'll be able to file a flight plan like today a corporate jet does an IFR flight plan. And I think we'll
instrument
know,
flight rules.
Instrument similar to that. They'll call it drone rules. But it'll be close to that so that everybody can look on the radar and see where you're at. Our small drones, even our new one, has what's called ADS-B out. So it's the same identifier that an airliner has or
a transponder
plane.
That
transponder
tells you where it is.
So that they can pick us up on the radar. And it's very exciting because, as you know, our legislature passed to put radar across the whole state. And so that will open up all of the other industries. I was out of Big Iron, then that'll blow up ag drones as well because now everybody can use them. Today, it's more around the aviation, certain infrastructure, but I think that many, many professions will be using drones in the future.
So that's an indication of how disruptive this technology can be because when you talk about ag applications, well, chemical applications is one thing that is currently done by, pilots. Mm-hmm. Drones might be able to do it in a more exacting fashion.
They have been for many, many years in Japan using small helicopters, drone helicopters. Here, they carry so much weight that I don't know that that'll happen soon. But, a lot of the tractors are driverless now. I mean, when you look at all the things, it's not out of reach. I don't know if you and I will ever fly on an airliner without a pilot, but I could see our cargo bags or freight going on pilotless aircraft.
Well, let's talk a bit about what we might see looking up in the sky in what's left of my life. I hope I've got a few years left. Say 20 years from now when I look up, how much of what I see up there will be piloted and how much of it will be unpiloted?
Oh, I would probably say 20 years from today, maybe 30, 40% would be unmanned and 60, 70 manned. I don't see society allowing some things, right? I don't see 100 drones buzzing around downtown Fargo right now, delivering us pizza or delivering us, you know,
Amazon.
No, I know. But I mean, I see the citizens not being so excited about that. But maybe I'm wrong. The technology will be there to do it. There's just an awful lot of things you can do. You know, they're inspecting railroad tracks now. We're inspecting power lines now. Farm fields, we've done quite a bit of ag. The issue we have today with ag is it's so much data when you fly a quarter of sugar beets or a quarter of corn that you can't process the data fast enough to make an input decision for the farmer.
Wow.
We can get him great data, right? But I can get it to you in 10 days. Well, he needs it tomorrow to decide if I put on chemical, don't put on chemical, do I have aphids, do I have a problem? We've done a lot of insurance flying. We've done survey work for Ellingson Drain Tile. They're one of our customers. So there again, they used to make three trips to a field before they put in the tile. Well, now we can go and cut it down to one or two trips because we can do the surveying for the drainage and those type of things.
And we've heard about drones being used to do sensing in the oil patch, for that matter.
Yeah, we have a big proposal and to actually inspect gravel roads out there. Because what happens now, like when the rain event we had yesterday here, they shut down all gravel roads to all trucks if they have a half inch or more. Well, that shuts off all the economics too. So if we could get real-time data to an engineer's where they could decide, hey, county roads 1, 3, and 5 are open, 2, 4, and 6 are closed, something along those lines, or close them for less time. Right now they just close them all, not knowing. So they are putting weather stations out on the gravel roads to monitor, and then we'll tie in with their data and hopefully help that industry.
Tommy Kenville is CEO of EyeSight RPV Services. He graduated from the University of North Dakota years ago with a bachelor's degree in marketing. He spent 15 years with the UND Aerospace Foundation, eventually becoming the vice president of business development. He's got a lot of entrepreneurial experience. And you've got this company, EyeSight RPV Services, which you've been talking about, contracts here, contracts there. So you must be bullish on the future.
I'm very excited, Doug, that we're able to retain young, talented, highly technical people in North Dakota. That's probably the most fun for me. We're at about 20 employees right now. 14 of those are operator type that are out flying the drones, and the others are myself and a few other owners. And our company, I formed the first drone company in North Dakota in 2010, but it was either not very smart or way early, however, because you couldn't fly back then. And so I worked on payload curriculum training, those kind of things. And then 2017, a company that we had helped up at the Center of Innovation, startup, some young guys in their 30s came to me and I helped them start. And then they came in and said, hey, let's merge. So there's three owners, two young North Dakotans from Wahpeton, Adam Lingwald and Nathan Lieben, and then myself. And so we're having a good time. We're making it. It took a lot of trial and error on the pricing and those type of things. And I'll be one of the speakers at DisruptWell in Bismarck. And I'm excited to see the crowd there and hopefully a bunch of entrepreneurs, you know, with ideas.
Well, you'll be speaking at that third annual DisruptWell Summit. It's Tuesday. It's tomorrow in the Bismarck State College National Energy Center of Excellence. So what message are you going to bring to DisruptWell?
I'm going to tell them that you can start businesses, that drones are cool. I know there is some businesses, drone businesses already in Bismarck. A lot of engineering firms, I think, will start using more drones for survey work. So it's exciting, you know. And my biggest thing is, hey, you're an entrepreneur, whether you're in radio or you're in a car business or construction, get out there, create some jobs, have some fun, you know. Don't worry, right? Because a lot of people don't dare to start the business. And I came from an entrepreneurial family, so I don't look at it as that kind of risk, right? But I hope we're a very entrepreneurial state. I hope there's a lot of questions about what types of drones we have. We're going to be making an announcement of a new one we just bought that's gas-powered, can stay in the air 6 hours. So critical, the beyond visual line of sight piece, because otherwise I have a drone that is way overkill. But it's all American-made. It's big. I can show you a picture of it. It's really a neat product, and hopefully that'll be a game changer for us to, you know, take down more data.
Is this a hybrid drone?
Yes, it is. It's called a hybrid drone, and what it does is it has a VTOL takeoff capability, so we could launch it right out on the street in front of the broadcast center here.
Vertical takeoff.
Vertical takeoff and landing. But then when it gets to altitude, the gas-powered engine kicks on. And it has 1 gallon of gas, and it's got a huge wingspan, and it really goes fast and can handle the high winds, and really cool airplane.
So what kinds of applications might this aircraft have?
So we've done some flying for the test site and the UTM project, trying to locate our plane in the sky with the different radars. We could do ag. We'll hopefully use it for the gravel road project to talk to you about. We're going to use it for power lines. You know, there's a lot of uses, and you can use it for just normal imagery too. A lot of people do, you know, real estate imagery and pictures of land and pictures of homes, and we're capable of that. We don't really focus on that market. We're more infrastructure inspection, counting cattle. We've done a project in Wyoming where we had to locate pronghorn sheep up in the mountains, and the guys had a lot of fun with that. So there's just a lot of uses for these drones, and you know, every day is kind of a new, you know, try it and see if it works. And
well, we're kind of getting used to it too. If you watch a newscast these days or you watch a movie, you're likely going to see a shot that has been taken from a drone. There used to be helicopters, very expensive proposition with very complicated gyroscopic cameras and all that kind of thing. But now with a drone, you can take a splendid image and use it for all kinds of stuff.
Exactly. I mean, we have near IR, infrared, LIDAR, video, stills. I mean, it's not limitless. And we try to buy what we have business for because, as you know, cameras and that kind of technology can get expensive. One of the bigger issues we have in our industry is the is there isn't a lot of historical data out there on the drones and the manufacturers. So they'll sell it to a company like ours saying that it's commercial grade, but it's not Chevy or Ford or Bobcat. It's not tough like that. It's not proven.
We do have some weather circumstances here that are unique.
We do. You know, we cut off in the winter at 0 degrees because we just don't want our guys outside. But we've flown power lines in northern Minnesota at 0 degrees, and you know, we got the data, but it was tough.
But now if you're talking about beyond visual line of sight, those guys can be inside.
Yeah, they could be sitting in a vehicle or sitting in an office like this, and the plane could be flying, you know, somewhere else.
Now, you mentioned earlier the importance of adding radar capacity in the state or anywhere that drones fly because they need to be sensed, they need to be seen. When I was at the UAS conference in Grand Forks, they were talking about sort of an experimental process they had done with the airport at Hillsboro.
Mm-hmm.
Tell our listeners about that.
So the Grand Sky up at the Grand Forks Air Base is the first private drone park. And Hillsboro, they put the first radar at Hillsboro and at Grand Sky. So that area has radar coverage. And we've flown in a what I call a controlled beyond line of sight situation. And to prove that the technology works, to prove that the radar can find us and see, and then what are our procedures to avoid, you know, like crop dusters. We're flying at the altitude that crop dusters do. So we usually notified the local crop duster that we're going to be flying at the Hamilton farm between 10 and 2, and just so they know, you know, situational awareness. But thankfully, the governor put in $33 million for radar and UAS-related activities and equipment. The legislature, I believe the number was $28 million that was passed for this radar. We have 38 emergency towers in the state that are systematically located for, like, tornado warnings and things like that.
So ideally located for this additional service, huh?
So we'll put the radar on most of those towers. They might use some other methods as well, but that's a very logical one. And then I see users like myself paying a fee to be on the radar. They haven't come out with a plan yet, but that's how I see it kind of working out, like a cable bill or how much data, you know, like your phone bill, that we would, you know, pay so much to be seen. But then that'll make it a lot safer. We still have to deal with, you know, in general aviation, I call the you know, like the flying farmer, right? He has a little tail drag or a small airplane. Legally, he can take off at his farm, go look around, not radio anybody, just go fly around. And so he so much doesn't have to see us as we have to see him to avoid him. And so they have technology out, you know, that people can acquire. The FAA had some discounts to current airplane owners, but ultimately they'll all have some type of identifier on everything in the air.
Well, everything on the ground is slowly getting to radar and sort of a crash avoidance kind of stuff too. So this technology is really blossoming, and it has lots of applications, obviously.
So our state systematically, when Senator Hovind was governor, he literally, you know how small North Dakota is, Doug. He literally called me and he said, "Tommy, this is John." And he said, "What do you think about this drone industry?" And I said, "You know, John, it's going to change the world like the internet, but I just don't know when because of the rules." Back then they started systematically investing in this industry. And today we have a few thousand jobs in this industry already, and it's growing extremely fast. Grand Sky has Northrop Grumman and General Atomics, two heavy, heavy hitters.
And they've built up
there. They've built mega build. I mean, hundreds of millions worth of buildings out there in the last few years. Very high paying software engineer type jobs, pilots, mechanics, you know, all the things that go with the drone. And so it's very exciting times. UND had the first collegiate program. NDSU has in their ag extension. Wappanen School of Science has a program.
Thief River Falls
has. Thief River has. Lake Region. So the schools are adding it kind of like English class, right? There's always some version that you can use a drone for. And so it's going to change North Dakota. And because we were a leader in aviation, it gave us this opportunity to be a leader in the drone world. You know, Customs and Border Patrol, Happy Hooligans down here, the Air Force and Grand Forks, they're all using different types of drones.
The state, UND, the Air Force, these private enterprises that have kind of joined forces to develop this remarkable future industry, if you will. And as you mentioned, North Dakota is on the cutting edge of it nationally and perhaps internationally, that the beginning of the UAS summit in Grand Forks, Senator Hovind made that announcement about the 60-mile radius test of beyond visual line of sight drone use, basically to break through that very important barrier that still remains.
You know, and we've been very lucky because every one of our politicians is for this industry. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. They all see the benefit. One of the big things is trying to educate kids, right? When you're in junior high school, what major should I go into? Well, if they're good gamers or they're good on the computers, which most kids are today, we want them to think about this major. So one of the things we did at the summit, our company, is we sponsored 100 college students from the schools I mentioned earlier. And because look at these careers. All the companies are looking for people. And, you know, we want to get down into the high schools and the middle schools that, hey, you could stay in North Dakota and have a very high-tech job that's fun if you want. So it's exciting times in our industry. I'm very thankful that we're doing it and we're leading the nation from North Dakota. As you mentioned earlier, we do have weather here. Well, guess what? All these drones have to be able to fly in all the weather. And we have a less population. So there's areas we can go practice and not be flying over people or over, you know, where it creates a danger. So it's really the perfect place, and we have a lot of great hardworking people here that are really showing North Dakota well. So,
Tommy Kenville is the CEO of EyeSight RPV Services, and he'll be speaking at the third annual Disrupt Well Summit tomorrow at the Bismarck State College National Energy Center of Excellence. If you want to find out more about that summit, just go online to Disrupt Well, and you'll find it. There's lots of information there. Tommy, thanks for dropping by.
Well, thank you for having me, Doug.
More Main Street in a moment.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. The 2019-2020 season, Symphonic Stories, begins with Gershwin, 7:30 p.m., Saturday, September 21st, at the Bell Mayhus Auditorium, featuring Braden Drevlow on the piano as we perform popular favorites by George Gershwin. For concert and ticket information, visit BismarckMandanSymphony.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. 50 years ago, a lawyer and professor and Standing Rock Sioux tribe member named Vine Deloria Jr. wrote a book around a collection of essays he titled Custer Died for Your Sins, an Indian Manifesto. His book offered a wry look at the ways the government had tried to help Native Americans. Commentator Mark Trahan says it was important when it was first published in 1969 and remains significant today.
Custer Died for Your Sins was a manifesto, a bestseller, and a banned book, a trifecta. So much literature back then went something like this. Once there was a great chief, say Chief Joseph, who led his people past danger and outmaneuvered a powerful U.S. Army. But instead of a climactic victory, Chief Joseph almost reached Canada. Almost. The Nez Perce people almost won, and the American Indian leader was almost great. Boil it down, story after story, and the condensed version of Native history was reduced to an almost narrative. American Indians were included in America's master narrative only in the context of failure. But Custer Died for Your Sins took that old, flat American Indian history and crumpled it until the dimensions were recognizable and honest. Most books about Indians cover abstract and esoteric topics of the last century, Deloria wrote. Contemporary books are predominantly by whites trying to solve the Indian problem. Between the two extremes lives a dynamic people in a social structure of their own to be freed from cultural expression. And he freed a lot of cultural expression. That includes the radical idea that one of the best ways to understand a people is to know what makes them laugh. Laughter encompasses the limits of the soul. In humor, life is redefined and accepted. Here was a book about American thought, policy, and history that devoted an entire chapter to humor, words that should have destroyed the stereotype of the wooden Indian. Custer Died for Your Sins was a manifesto. It demanded the right of American Indians to control their image in rich detail. And manifesto was precisely the right word, a declaration of principles, policies, and intentions in a political context. But the book had a dual manifesto. To American Indian readers, it was a call to arms, a plea to recognize the essence of tribal philosophy, political systems, and religion. As Deloria wrote, there is more to the story than that. Indian people today have a chance to recreate a type of society for themselves, which can defy, mystify, and educate the rest of American society. Yet they mill around like so many cattle, not bringing them to the surface the greatness that is in them. Looking back over 50 years, it's clear that the most significant contribution of the book was the idea that American Indians could control our own narrative, owning our own story. Then it's not just our story. At a conference last week, Haskell Indian Nations University professor Daniel Wildcat said the day will come when Vine Deloria Jr. is remembered as one of the 20th century's greatest thinkers. I'm Mark Trahant.
Mark is the editor of the online news service Indian Country Today. Coming up on Main Street, a constitutional law professor explains why the Electoral College was created to select the winning presidential candidate. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission says the commission is working to expand broadband internet capability in rural America. Ajit Pai attended a roundtable discussion in Bismarck on that subject. He says the FCC is working to target parts of the country that do not yet have broadband.
And especially in rural America, there are some gaps there. That gap is what we call the digital divide. And as someone who grew up in rural America, I'm from a small town in Kansas originally, I want to make sure that every American, especially those in rural areas, has access to digital platforms.
David Crothers is the executive vice president of the Broadband Association of North Dakota. That group is made up of cooperatives and small commercial telecom companies.
North Dakota is very unique in that over 96% of the geographic territory is served by locally owned companies. What that means for for investment in modern infrastructure for North Dakotans to be able to access the latest and fastest and greatest services is almost incalculable.
But Grothers says there are still some areas of North Dakota without available broadband, places along the Red River Valley and in central North Dakota.
Where we are not the incumbent provider, we're more than willing to go in and bring those same services to those people that we have within our own territories, but we need that recognition by Washington that they deserve that same service too.
Pai says he knows the demand for internet service is growing by leaps and bounds.
It's very much like Kevin Costner's character in A Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. If you build high capacity infrastructure, new services and applications will develop to take advantage of it.
Pai says the $10 billion Universal Service Fund is being targeted toward unserved rural areas, and he says there are changes forthcoming to make it easier for private companies to build the internet infrastructure. And state health department officials say the fifth of the planned eight medical marijuana dispensaries is slated to open Tuesday. The latest dispensary is located in Devil's Lake. Medical marijuana division director Jason Wall says the original plan was to tackle the issue of distance between shops by creating eight regions to be served by a dispensary.
Obviously, with a rural population, we wanted to have dispensaries just not located in particular areas so people had to travel long distances. Obviously, there's still going to be some people who need to travel a ways to a potential dispensary, but if their condition was such that travel is difficult, they could always have a designated caregiver, you know, that could make that drive for them, pick up their product, and bring it back to them.
Wall says dispensaries in Minot and Jamestown are expected to be open by the end of the month. In terms of availability of product for medical marijuana patients, Wall says the grow operation in Bismarck continues to provide products for the entire state.
We are getting the other facility closer to the packaging process where they'll be able to transport some products to dispensaries as well.
By midweek last week, there had been almost 1,200 medical marijuana cards delivered to eligible patients across North Dakota. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by telephone by Richard Duncan. He's a professor of property and constitutional law at the University of Nebraska College of Law. And the reason he's joining us is because he will be the featured speaker tomorrow at the UND Constitution Day celebration. Professor Duncan, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Your lecture is titled Electoral Federalism from 1789 to 2020, the Presidency and the Senate. That's a dry title, but it's a pretty provocative discussion. So let's get into some definitions to begin here. First of all, the definition of federalism.
Yeah, well, the idea behind federalism is that it's another part of separation of powers. You know, the federal government has separation of powers between the three branches of government, between Congress, the legislative branch, the president, the executive branch, and the courts, the judicial branch. But there's also this other type of separation of powers, that is between the federal government, which is a government only of enumerated powers. The federal government does not have broad plenary powers. They simply have the powers that the Constitution specifically gives to the federal government. And then all other power, and this was made clear under the 10th Amendment, is reserved to the states and we the people in the states through the 10th Amendment. So federalism is really that division of power between the national government on the one hand and the state governments that retain quite a bit of their sovereignty on the other hand.
Constitution Day is September 17th. It's a federal observance that recognizes the adoption of the U.S. Constitution because it was September 17, 1787. The delegates to the Constitutional Convention signed the document in Philadelphia. So that's the historical relevance of having Constitution Day and your appearance at UND tomorrow. But let's go back in history here. What were the various proposals for the handling of presidential elections when the Constitution was being debated?
Right. Well, there was obviously a large debate. Here's the background, is we've got 13 sovereign states. They're loosely connected through the Articles of Confederation, but the states are still very sovereign. They are independent of the federal government. And because the Articles of Confederation didn't create a sufficiently strong federal government, they decided they were going to get together and create a stronger federal government. under something called the Supremacy Clause. So if the federal government acts pursuant to its legitimate powers, then those federal laws are the supreme law of the land, and they are binding on the states. And so here we have these 13 independent states, sovereign states, and they're being asked to give up some of their sovereignty. And there was a real concern, particularly between the large population states such as Virginia on the one hand and the small population states such as Delaware and Connecticut on the other hand, that, you know, that their state interests would be preserved. And so the large states would have liked something that would give more power based upon population. And the smaller states were really very concerned about state equality, sort of one state, one vote, that each state in the union would be equal.
Well, that, of course, is the argument for the Electoral College versus the popular vote.
And also for the United States Senate. I mean, it's really interesting. I sometimes joke that my new favorite founding father is a guy by the name of Gunning Bedford, someone that no one's ever heard of. He was the delegate to the Constitutional Convention from Delaware. And when they were having this debate, you know, he basically said, look, these large population states want an enormous and monstrous power. And there is no way that I will give that to them, and so the great compromise is what we ended up with is the United States Senate was treated with state equality. Each state gets two senators, no matter how large or how small the state. So California, with 35 or maybe now up to 38 million people, get two United States senators. And Wyoming, with a population of about 500,000, they get two United States senators. So that was the part of the compromise that benefited the smaller states. And the larger states got proportional representation in the House of Representatives. And then the electoral system was a combination of the two. Basically, the number of electoral votes each state gets is the number of House seats in the state plus the number of Senate seats in the state. So Wyoming gets three electoral votes, one House seat, two Senate seats. California gets 55 electoral votes, two Senate seats, 53 seats in the House of Representatives. So even the Electoral College is tilted in favor of the large population states, but it is, I guess you would say it is slightly, it slightly favors the small population states.
Well, that would be North Dakota. We have two senators, one representative. So
right.
We're like Wyoming tilting against
right.
That California windmill.
Yeah, Grover Norquist likes to joke that Wyoming is a state with a population of three, two of whom are United States senators, and one of whom is a member of the House of Representatives. But maybe North Dakota is probably pretty similar. But here's the real benefit, I think, of the electoral system. The reason I think it is continuing to be a source of good, a brilliant, Alexander Hamilton said the system, that it called it excellent. He said it may not be perfect, but it's an excellent system for electing the president. And the reason for that is it doesn't allow the president to be elected by running up the score in one or two or three large population states. It requires a successful presidential candidate to have a national coast-to-coast consensus among the states, because you need to win enough state presidential elections to accumulate enough electoral votes to win an electoral college majority.
So this is the fact that we have no national election in the United States, because every election, as you have written in a paper, for national office is held in the states. So
that's
it's the
exactly
state's
right.
Outcome.
We have no true national elections. The people who represent us in the national government are all elected in the states. The House of Representatives, our congressmen, are elected in districts in the states, and they represent their district, not the nation. United States senators are elected in each state, and they represent their state, not the nation. and presidents are elected through state elections for presidential electors. And, you know, so there's a separate presidential election. There are actually 51 popular vote presidential elections. There's not one national popular vote, but there are 51 popular vote elections in the states plus the District of Columbia. And the winner of each state gets the electoral votes for that particular state. So if you win Wyoming, you get Wyoming's three electoral votes. And it doesn't matter what they do in California. It doesn't matter what they do in New York. The candidate who wins Wyoming gets Wyoming's electoral votes. So it is federally democratic, as I like to put it, as opposed to nationally democratic.
Richard Duncan is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Nebraska College of Law. Professor Duncan, a lot has been made of the 3 million vote disparity between the outcome mandated by the Electoral College and the total vote of the most recent popular presidential vote across the country. And I've heard a disparity as large as 5 million votes might be possible. Doesn't that create a political problem? Not a legal one, but a political one.
Well, it shouldn't. I think the 2016 election is an example of the Electoral College performing at its best. If you look, I think Hillary Clinton won by a little. There is no national popular vote, but if you add up all the votes in the states, Hillary Clinton had roughly a plurality. She did not win a majority, but she won a plurality of roughly 3 million votes more than Donald Trump, 3 million popular votes more than Donald Trump. But she won California by more than 4 million votes, and she won New York by more than 2 million votes. So if you set those two states aside, that means Trump actually won the other 48 states by 3 million votes. Plus, Trump won the counties. There are roughly 3,000 counties in America. And Trump won 2,600 and Hillary won just a few over 400 counties. So when you look at the electoral map, you see that the Electoral College is working just the way it was supposed to work. Rather than allow California and New York to exert that monstrous influence that Gunning Bedford talked about in 1787, it required the winner of the presidency to have a national consensus. You know, Hillary Clinton did not win Wisconsin. She did not win Michigan. She did not win several states that she thought, several other states that she thought she ought to win. And, you know, and that hurt her because you need that national consensus, and she didn't get it.
Well, in those states, and you're right, if you look at an Electoral College map of the United States in the most recent election, there's an awful lot of red there, state
by
state.
Almost completely red, yeah.
But if you look at population centers in a lot of those individual states, you'll see a lot of blue.
Right.
Even within the states, there's this kind of disparity, if you will.
Right.
And over the last, many, many years, besides the Clinton versus Trump election, there have been four other instances of the what is perceived, and I'm stressing that, as the national popular vote versus the electoral vote, where the plurality winner has actually lost the contest.
Right.
And that does get into an issue of law versus the perception of the law.
Yeah. Well, I think a misperception of the law. If you understand that the purpose of the electoral system is to require a successful presidential candidate to govern by consensus, not just to run up the score. I mean, I like to use a World Series example sometimes. Imagine if the Red Sox and the St. Louis Cardinals are in the World Series, and the Red Sox win game one of the World Series 20-0. And then the Cardinals win the next four games 1-0. Well, the Red Sox could claim they won the popular run election, that they scored 20 runs and St. Louis only scored 4 runs. But in fact, St. Louis won 4 games. And it's this, they had a consensus of the games. They won by a consensus of the games. And that's what we're talking about here. It's not enough to run up the score. In Los Angeles and New York City and San Francisco and Chicago and maybe one or two other large urban areas, you have to have a campaign. You have to have an agenda that you offer the people that can win a consensus among the country. You can't ignore all of those big red states in the middle of the country. You have to appeal to them as well. You can't just run in the big cities. And again, that was the whole reason for this compromise, is that the delegates from the small states were worried that they would be dominated by the large population states, by the enormous and monstrous voting power of the large states. And they created a system that would require government by consensus rather than government by raw national popular vote. This is the United States is a federal republic, not a unitary national democracy.
Richard Duncan is a professor of constitutional law. He'll be speaking at the Constitution Day celebration at UND on Tuesday. It takes place at the School of Law Baker Courtroom. It's free and open to the public, and it'll take place at noon. It's sponsored by the UND School of Law Federalist Society, and we've been talking about the Electoral College and the way we select senators and presidents in the United States. And you were talking about the preponderance, obviously, of the electoral support for the most recent president, the one currently in office, Donald Trump. There's a complication here, though, not just with the perceived national popular vote and the misperception of the law that drives the Electoral College. We do have a president who, by lots of analysis, is playing to a base and not a broad national consensus. And that seems to be a little bit of a fly in the ointment here.
Well, I think every they play to the base until they're running for a national election, and then you have to win Peoria, you have to win Indiana and Michigan and Wisconsin, and so you can't just play any more than the Democrats are running to their base, basically free everything for everybody. That's they're appealing to the small economic democratic socialist base of the party. But to win election, you've got to go broader than that. So what you often will see, is, in primaries, they'll run to their base because the base are the ones who are most likely to show up at primaries. But then when it's the Democrats versus the Republicans in the national election, they have to kind of move toward the center. I think Trump is running on the economy, which has broad support. It's the economy is great. Unemployment is down, and wages are up, and taxes have been cut. And I think those are things that are broadly popular. When he tweets, he's tweeting to his base. But when he governs, I think he's governing in a way that people throughout the country can appreciate. The economy, people throughout the country can appreciate his support for tax cuts, and I guess we're really divided on immigration, but I think most of us would like somewhat sealed borders, but a lot of mercy for people who are already here. And my guess is that's where they'll eventually come out if they can ever sit down and reach a bipartisan deal on immigration.
Well, we almost unavoidably are creeping into political science here as opposed to
right.
the law. But so I want to bring this back
right.
to a very specific question because I think there has been an instance or two of this. Are the electors of the Electoral College bound to vote for a particular presidential candidate?
Well, that's not clear. The Tenth Circuit just said that they are free to vote for whoever they want to vote for. And once they're elected, their judgment is in place. And there's some support for this. The founders did not have a lot of trust in sort of popular democracy. The founders thought that in fact, we don't even have to have presidential elections under the original Constitution. Under the Constitution as it continues to be written today, each state gets to decide how to select presidential electors. We don't need to have an election. George Washington did not get one popular vote. George Washington was elected unanimously by the Electoral College, but he did not get one single vote because each state simply selected the electors who then voted for President Washington. So we don't even need to have elections. And the founders believe that these electors, you know, should be able to exercise a certain amount of discretion, that we were electing them, not the presidential candidates. So there's one argument that, and I think the Tenth Circuit just held this, that electors are free to, you know, to vote their conscience. I think that would be a big mistake. I think if you have elections and the people of, you know, whatever, say the people of North Dakota vote for President Trump, the electors ought to basically respect that vote. Once we've decided to have electors elected democratically, I believe the electors have a moral duty to respect that vote, but it's not clear that they have a legal duty to do so. Indeed, there were some faithless electors in the last election. I think there were four or five electors who voted their conscience. And so President Trump's majority in the Electoral College actually increased because I think Hillary Clinton lost more faithless electors than President Trump lost.
Well, as a student of federalism and an advocate of the Electoral College, what do you see as the strongest arguments against your position?
Well, you know, I think if you want to have a completely different system of government, if you said, what's this states thing? Why don't we just have one big old country? Let's call it America. Let's take the United States out of it and just call it America. Then, you know, I guess there's a reasonable position that we ought to have a unitary national democracy and have no states at all. Now, that's not what I like. And, you know, and if we had a brand new constitutional convention and that's what was being proposed, I would be suggesting that my state stay out of that and not bother to ratify that constitution. But, you know, I suppose you could say we ought to have one big national democracy. But if we have that, then you have to recognize that those large population centers are going to be pretty much be able to dictate whatever they want with one-size-fits-all national laws that govern us all. The beautiful thing about federalism is if we can prevent the federal government from sticking its nose into every single matter, the federal government stays out of some issues, then what we have what I call 50 shades of federalism. Every state can go their own way. California can have laws that work for Californians, and North Dakotans can have laws that work for North Dakotans. And those might be completely different laws. I mean, this is what we had with marriage until the Supreme Court intervened and declared same-sex marriage on all 50 states. We had a system where California was free if they wanted to recognize same-sex marriage and say North Dakota was free if they wanted to continue with traditional marriage. But then the Supreme Court nationalized the issue of marriage, and now it's one size fits all. I don't particularly like one size fits all laws on a country that's as diverse as our country is. I think we need lots of different shades of federalism, lots of different sizes that fit different types of people.
Well, on your last example, I think you'd get a vigorous debate. And of course, Nebraska has this unique unicameral legislature. So
right.
I guess one size doesn't fit all, and it's a very interesting amalgam of states that we live among. Richard Duncan, thank you for spending some time with us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Richard Duncan is a professor of property and constitutional law at the University of Nebraska College of Law. He'll be speaking at the Constitution Day celebration tomorrow at the UND campus and the Baker Courtroom. It's free and open to the public. And the title of the lecture is Electoral Federalism from 1789 to 2020, the Presidency and the Senate. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. All of us here want to thank you as a member, and wrapping up our fall membership drive is a great time to do it. So thanks to you if you called or joined online, and of course you may be a sustaining member, as many people are now, and you don't even need to call. However you do it, your support keeps us going. I'll also thank Atomic Coffee, Red River Coffee, McDonald's, and Sandy's Donuts, and the volunteers who helped answer the phones. If you haven't done it, made a contribution, well, you can still call 800-359-4145 or go to prairiepublic.org. Our listener supporters, you make it all possible. You do this, so this is here for you, so let's all thank each other for keeping it going.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchesne. realtor and broker with Hatch Realty, serving home buyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck-Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 16th. North Dakota remembers Teddy Roosevelt, marking 100 years since his passing, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. Theodore Roosevelt's first step into Dakota Territory was not to Western cowboy country, but to Fargo-Moorhead. His first tangle with wildlife was with birds, not bison. And when 21-year-old Theodore and his 20-year-old brother Elliot left the Red River Valley after 10 days of hunting with new shotguns, the area was minus 208 critters, prairie chickens, ducks, plovers, coots, grebes, and more. That was acceptable hunting style in September of 1880. The next month, he would marry Alice, and over the next few years, Roosevelt became the youngest man elected to the New York State Assembly, published his first book, The Naval War of 1812, and shot his first bison in the Badlands.
We started off driving straight across country, nearly getting mired in a slough, killed several ducks from the wagon, and finally hid behind some wheat sheaves and shot two geese out of a flock which flew overhead. Before we had risen in the morning, we were roused by the whistle of wings as a flock of ducks flew by along the course of the stream. Lying in our blankets, we could plainly hear all the motions. First of all, the whistle of their wings, then the long-drawn splash, plump, and then a low, conversational quacking. It was too dark to shoot, but we got up and ready and strolled down along the bank of the river opposite where we could hear them. And as soon as we could see, gave them four barrels and picked up half a dozen scalp ducks. We have had great fun on this trip. I have never had a better hunt, but I am awfully homesick for Alice and shall be too delighted to see her again.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Just a moment left in Main Street, but enough time to thank those of you who called us during our fall membership drive to become members or to increase your support of Prairie Public and Main Street, and for that we thank you very much. If you're still thinking about it, the phone still works. It's 800-359-4145, or you can go online to prairiepublic.org and just click on Donate. It all helps. Tuesday on our show, Carrie Pickett received a Lifetime Achievement Award from Minnesota State University Moorhead School of Art for her career as a photographer, filmmaker, and author. She'll join us to talk about her work and a new exhibit called Track Record. And we'll discuss this week's Soil and Water Summit and Field Trip with moderator Lance Loken and field tour leader Alan Ashworth. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.